This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. The city of Kannapolis embarked on a unique path to the revitalization of their downtown. The city bought a large chunk of their downtown. In fact, almost all of it, in hopes of priming the pump for development. We talked about this when they first announced the purchase, and today, as part of our ongoing Block by Block series, we get an update. But first, a recent shooting of a deaf man by the Highway Patrol has raised awareness of the challenges facing the deaf in a hearing world. Among those challenges are the struggles the hard of hearing face just interacting with those of us who can hear and vice versa. So we spend the first part of the program working to get some insight. Julia Sain is Executive Director of Disability Rights and Resources. That's an organization that started here in 1980 and which serves a four-county area, Cabarrus, Gaston, Mecklenburg, and Union counties. And she joins us here in our Spirit Square studio. Good morning. Welcome.
Good morning. Thank you, Mike.
You're welcome. First, this really surprised me yesterday. I want to get this out of the way at the very top of the conversation. I understand that people in the deaf community like to be referred to as deaf or hard of hearing and not hearing impaired. Why?
You're partly right there,
okay.
Mike. People in the deaf community prefer to be referred to as deaf. There is deaf and there's hard of hearing. People who use technology, hearing aids, captioning on the television to hear, people who are hard of hearing, that with some technology can hear, are hard of hearing.
Right.
People who can hear and were raised in the deaf community, deaf culture, deaf language are deaf, and nobody's hearing impaired. Hearing impaired is a term that we hearing people decided to use to talk about those folks. One of the things at my agency is we like to say nothing about me without me. We talk to people and ask them. And deaf community is a culture. It has a shared history. It has morals and ethical diversity that is very that is studied in a lot of places. There are whole college courses just about deaf culture and the language, the American Sign Language, that they share. People who are deaf do not have a camaraderie just because of a physical characteristic. All people with curly hair don't sit around and talk about that as a physical characteristic, our shared history, you know, and all of that, our language, because that's not – we have a physical characteristic, but we don't have a shared culture. The people who are deaf, raised in the deaf community – deaf culture, American Sign Language, that is not hearing impaired. Impaired automatically means broken. You're not woman impaired. You like who you are as a person. So you don't want me to refer to you that way, and I wouldn't. So we don't refer to somebody who's deaf as hearing impaired. That's taking me and comparing you to me, and you're the impaired one.
Wow. And I guess we arrived at the use of the term hearing impaired because it was viewed as more politically correct, less impolite, I guess is the word to use. And in other areas, we no longer use the word handicapped. We use Well, why not? What's the difference between using the word handicapped versus handy-abled or whatever the term is at the moment. And the difference between hard of hearing and hearing impaired. It seems like we're, you know, splitting hairs here.
It does seem like that. And the last thing, if you were to know me at all, you would know the last thing I am is politically correct. And so that's not the reason I'm here. If that was my job, I would not do it. Because, first of all, the word handicapped has a history of meaning to make something less than it can be.
Okay.
You handicap horses. You handicap great golfers because you make them less than they can be. Now, we could get into the whole etiology of that term, but the point is it always refers to something less than the rest of us.
Okay.
And that, how rude is that? So based upon a comparison to whom, right?
Mm-hmm.
And so, but still again, I say that within the community of people who have ear things, the hard of hearing are people who can use technology to hear. You know, my father wears a hearing aid. You know some people who probably do that type of thing. That's hard of hearing.
Okay.
But then you've got the deaf community, which is not the same thing at all. It is a culture. It is has a shared language and all of that.
And I want to talk about that because that's yesterday reading about this is the first time I ever heard the term deaf culture.
That's fine.
So
I understand that.
I want to talk about one of the reasons that we're talking about this at all was the shooting of Daniel Harris,
yes.
who is that young man who was shot in his driveway in
yes.
Northeast Charlotte by a highway patrol officer. And we don't know the particulars of the incident, and I don't want to speculate on that. But in a conversation we had about this last Friday on the News Roundup, we got into this whole thing about do deaf people carry some sort of identification with them that identifies them as either deaf or hard of hearing that police officers could use to readily identify those people in the heat of the moment, if that's possible. And do officers here or elsewhere receive any special training to deal with people who are deaf or hard of hearing?
Okay. And again, I'm going to have to separate them deaf and hard of hearing.
Of course.
A person who is hard of hearing, someone who probably uses a hearing aid to hear, mm-hmm. When they can communicate with you just fine, and if you would just speak louder, we would have no problem. Because communication can go both ways. You can hear, they can hear with assistance, right? They know English, you know English, we're good to go. We're focusing on the deaf community, all right? And so I can tell you that there is such a thing as a visor card in different states. I know South Carolina has something like that. North Carolina has something like that. But here's the...
And a visor card literally is a card you pull out of your visor and hand to the police.
Right. And it is told that you put it over the visor. And typically because we do our driver visor down and up and down and up, uh-huh. people who are deaf will put it over their passenger visor. That one's not used as often. So here's the key. So you're sitting there. You've been pulled over by a police officer for whatever reason.
Mm-hmm.
You're nervous. I know I am in the many times it's happened to me. Let's don't go there. I'm not really sure what's going to happen. I'm not anything. I've got my hands on the and the police officer comes up and says, keep your hands where I can see them, right? And I don't know they said that.
Right.
So I move my hand immediately after they say, don't move your hand. I move it to reach for that visor card or worse, if it's in the glove compartment. Suddenly everything has escalated because I did not honor what you said, and I'm trying to help.
Right.
You don't know I'm trying to help. Why would you know I'm trying to help? It is that piece of it. I cannot speak to what the Highway Patrol training is because I want to be very clear about this. We're talking about a Charlotte situation, but it was not Charlotte-Mecklenburg Police because we work very closely with police departments here in Concord and Union County. Local police officers do get training in the Charlotte-Mecklenburg Police Department, and I've spoken with one of their majors in the past couple of days about the police officers are getting videos put out by the Department of Justice on interfacing with people at a stop who are deaf, and they say things like, watch their hands. Look at their lips. If they point to their ear, what does that mean?
But if you don't know the person you've just pulled over is deaf, that complicates the issue. So let's talk about that for a second.
Yes.
I'm told, and you just mentioned this, that the first people deaf people are often told to do when approached by law enforcement is to point to their ears to indicate, I guess, that would hope that would transmit information that I'm having trouble hearing you or I cannot hear you.
Correct.
How are most officers trained to understand that signal?
I don't know how most officers are trained. I know the ones that I train and the ones that I work with. Charlotte-Mecklenburg Police Department, I can say yes.
So is there a way around this? Because if you have this card that they can present to an officer that
right.
says I'm deaf
mm-hmm.
or I'm hard of hearing and mm-hmm. you're going to have to really speak up to for me to hear you,
mm-hmm.
Is there a way around this? Is there in the News Roundup, one of us asked, and it may have been me, could there not be some sort of decal on the window that says the driver is deaf or hard of hearing or some kind of indication on the tag of the vehicle that said the occupant of the car or the driver of the car is maybe even just a number. Like they get a series of a special letter in front of their license. Could that not be an answer to this problem? And when I asked that question on the roundup, someone said deaf people don't want that because it's dangerous for them.
Right. I listened to that show too.
Okay.
And so here's how I relate to that. There was a time, even in the Charlotte area, where the fire department requested that anybody who had a mobility disability put a sticker in their bedroom window. so that if there was a fire and the mm-hmm. fire department came to your home, they would know that there is a person there who has a physical disability.
Right.
And I'm sure that burglars would love to have to know where, which windows they can go in, where somebody with a disability is inside that window. The chance of having someone stop you is lessened. Mm-hmm. And so people were saying, well, that, why would I identify myself? I mean, I don't want a thing on my license tag to tell everybody in Charlotte, single woman driving alone at night.
Could there be something at the DMV? Because when you're pulled over by a police officer, I'm sure they usually check on their computer, or they phone it into, or they talk into their little microphones, and it goes to central and they look up your tag number. Could there be something associated with your tag number that is hidden from public view that would tell the officer you're dealing with a deaf person here?
I'm going to tell you that is all really good suggestions. And with this heightened awareness, uh-huh. now there's an opportunity for those of us who are advocates in the state to talk about what could be done. Okay. Now, that's not going to work if you're driving a rental car, say, for example.
Right. Right.
And so we look at those as possible ways to address things, and those are being addressed. Up until now, it was not something that, as you know, was in the discussion in the community. And people, if we had 3 weeks ago, 4 weeks ago, brought it up forward to the legislature, anybody like that, we wouldn't have even been given a moment.
Really?
Because it's not, it's like, well, prove to us that this is necessary.
But it wouldn't cost anything to do that.
Well, your mouth to the legislator's ears.
A lot of times we've been told in the past that people who use their radios too loud in the car, or their CD players too loud in the car, or now put their iPods, little earbuds in,
yes.
and crank that up while they're driving, are a hazard on the road because
yes,
they cannot hear sirens,
right.
and they cannot hear horns, etc. So let me ask an impolite question.
That's okay.
Should deaf people be driving?
Okay, excellent. Yes, but the rest of us should not. Let me tell you why. Because a person who is deaf, now there's this misperception out there that when you lose a sense, the rest of the senses heighten.
Uh-huh.
Well, that's not anatomically possible. But it's true that when you are not hearing, your eyes are more astute, you are more aware of quick movements in your periphery and things like that.
Well, we can assume that I think it was a 7-mile chase that
and that one we don't want to get into.
With blue lights.
I hear you. I've had that discussion with members of the community, and I can't speak to that. Here's what I can tell you, though, back to your question.
Okay.
I am not, as a hearing person, I depend so much on my hearing that if I'm walking down a sidewalk, or you are, and there's something that happens that darts out of the corner of my eye, I may or may not pick it up very quickly because I don't have to because I'm so used to depending on my ears. If I'm a deaf person and I'm not used to depending on my ears, my vision is more, I depend so much more on my vision that my vision is more astute. And therefore, I will pick up a quick movement in the corner of my eye faster than a person who is hearing and depends on other senses. Therefore, when I'm driving down the street with my windows up, with the air conditioning on, with my radio on, listening to you, I'm more of a danger, honestly, than a person who is driving down the road and is alert
mm-hmm.
with their eyes. You're never going to have a person who's deaf in an accident because they were on the phone.
Julia Sain is Executive Director of Disability Rights and Resources. That's an organization that... I think the name is self-evident what they do. We're going to come back and talk a little bit more about deaf culture and what that means, because, as I said, it's a term that I had never heard before yesterday. So we'll come back and do that, and then we'll find out more about the city of Kannapolis and their revitalization plans and where that stands at the moment. It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE.
On the next...
Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and the U.S. National Whitewater Center's Labor Day celebration on Sunday, September the 4th, featuring fireworks and live music from Robert Randolph and the Family Band. Details at usnwc.org. And Creative Loafing hosting Eat from a Truck with over 100 food trucks, Kids Zone, and live music Saturday, September the 10th at Avid Exchange Music Factory. Tickets available at eatfromatruck.com. In this online world, everything is gravitating to the web. Banking, shopping, you name it, it's all on the web. So why is it that we still wait in line to vote? According to a 2014 study, wait times in a recent election in North Carolina were more than an hour in some counties. What are some alternatives? How effective and secure would they be? How do we create a more efficient way to vote? And would it boost participation? We talk about that on this program tomorrow at 9.
On the next Diane Rehm Show, budget cutbacks have made it impossible for many states to finance their public schools, but many have bucked the trend by increasing taxes and earmarking those funds for education, taxes, spending, and the quality of public education.
Join the Diane Rehm Show from 10 to noon following Charlotte Talks on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE.
It's Charlotte Talks on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE and 90.3 WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. We're talking about deaf people today and those who are hard of hearing in light of what happened with Daniel Harris, who was shot and killed by a highway patrol officer after being pulled over, and he was deaf, Daniel Harris was. There are two kinds of deaf people. Julia Sain is with us. She's the Executive Director of Disability Rights and Resources. There are two kinds of deaf people. Those classified with a small d, I'm told, and those classified with a capital D.
Excellent.
And the capital D indicates that they speak American Sign Language, which is not English. It is a language unto itself. Why is that important to know?
Okay, well, one reason is because we do assume, because we haven't heard American Sign Language, that it is coded English. Morse code mm-hmm. is coded English. Semaphore is coded English. Even Braille is coded English. So we have no reason to believe that if you were to say the word, the sentence, the bird is sitting on a fence, and I'm an interpreter, you would assume that I'm going to sign make seven hand signs. The bird is sitting on the fence.
Okay.
That is not what's going to happen. Trust me. What I'm going to sign, and you would not hear it, is now fence, bird that, sit on. Now, the reason that's important.
There's a whole show in that answer. Well, go ahead.
I picked an easy sentence. The reason that's important, Mike, is because if, let's say a police officer, let's say an emergency room doctor, whips out a pencil and a piece of paper and writes a sentence and expects the person who's deaf to respond, they're going to respond the best they can in their second language, which is English, and it is not going to interpret, and the communication is going to be messed up.
So let me get this straight. Because these people have been trained, the deaf people with a capital D have been trained with American Sign Language.
Their native language.
When you hand them a piece of paper, or when they look at a newspaper or article or something, or they look at closed captioning on television, that's a second language to them.
Yes, they are bilingual if they get it, if they get the nuance and all of the syntax of that language.
Are most people who speak American Sign Language then bilingual? Can they understand printed English easily?
To a degree. I think that there are.
Why was it set up that way? Why isn't sign language duplicative of American English or French or German in those countries?
Well, the first sign language was created in France, and it is American Sign Language, because it was barred there, because that's where it started. A lot of American Sign Language is based on French language and French culture, because that's where it started, and then it was just adapted into our country. And the other thing that...
Well, that explains why the prepositions are in the wrong place.
Or your prepositions are in the wrong place. But the other thing I can tell you is that there is also, because there is an American Sign Language, just like there is American English, if you will, there is still nuances and dialects within the country.
So those who are deaf with a small d do right. not speak American Sign Language. How do they get along?
Well, some of them use depend on captioning, and they may learn word, mm-hmm. the vocabulary signs, and they need an interpreter then who could sign the bird is sitting on the fence. I know all of those signs, And that would make sense to somebody with a small D. It would not make sense to somebody with a capital D.
So those who lip read are most likely to be small D deaf or capital D deaf?
Small D deaf, but let me tell you about lip reading too, Mike. I've studied the anatomy of the voice. And so I can tell you that most of the sounds that we make are not made on the lips.
No, they're made in your throat.
And you can't see that.
Yeah, right.
And so if you, 7% of what a person says in an atmosphere of not stressed, I know you, and you don't have a mustache, you're not chewing gum, and you don't have your hands over your mouth, and I know the topic, I would get totally perfectly 7% of what you say.
Wow.
The rest of it, I assume, make up and not a lot.
We have made changes in the physical world for those who have
physical disabilities.
Yes. We've lowered curbs, we've put in ramps, etc.
Yes.
What have we done for deaf people, if anything, and if nothing, what should be done?
Well, globally, there isn't a whole lot you have to do. It's individually. If you are a doctor or you are an attorney or you are someone in the court system or whatever, and the person comes in and says, I need an interpreter, then you provide the interpreter. It's not something that can just be there all the time like the ramp. But you can put in, if you're in an apartment complex and you need to have, you have people who are deaf that live there, you put flashing doorbells instead of audible doorbells. The fire department can give away audible smoke detectors, and now they have a program where if the family is deaf, they can give away flashing smoke detectors. Mm-hmm. It's thinking it through and saying yes when the person needs that.
And you talk, we don't have time to go into this at length, and I think we're going to have you back to talk about this at some length, because I do want to talk about this deaf culture.
Good.
That you brought up.
Good.
Different moral and ethical standards or diversity within the deaf culture. What are some of the differences?
I'm going to give you one quick one.
Okay.
In the deaf community, the idea of the culture perpetuating to generation is honored. You want that to continue. The best way I can relate it is if you're an American Indian and you are full-blooded. You know that term? We talk about that sometimes and how honored that is. So we have the concept that we want the language to continue. We want the culture to continue. So if you have a deaf person who's married to a deaf person and they have a child, the first question other people in the community are going to ask is the child deaf or hearing? Before they say boy or girl, before they ask any of that, deaf or hearing, and because they test children at birth now, and if the person says deaf, the community celebrates. That's this concept that we don't have perhaps in the deaf community, because if I had a child and somebody asked me about the child and I said, well, the child is deaf, my hearing friends would be sad about that.
Yes.
That's one example.
I'm taking it from the name of your organization, Disability Rights and Resources, that you deal with the blind as well.
People who are blind, yes, we do.
Okay, so do they have a similar feeling about their condition as deaf people do?
They don't have their own language. Now, there is not a blind culture. There are characteristics of people who are blind, and we talk about their equipment and their dogs, and I'm not belittling that. There's ways to communicate with people who are blind, and we teach that to anybody that wants to hear it. But that is not the same as a shared history because of a shared language.
Okay. And the other thing that I want to bring up is that this is particularly critical for seniors in nursing centers because, you know, I think all of us will become all of us from the rock and roll generation are going to become hard of hearing at some point.
And sometimes we already are.
That's right. So for older Americans,
yes,
this is a serious problem. They
yes
need to have – some of them need interpreters in nursing facilities.
I don't know about interpreters. Because most people who are – so you are probably, as a person who we hope is going to be 112 years old and have a hearing loss – you're not going to be fluent in sign language anyway.
Okay.
You're going to need other technology to let you know what's going on. You might need text that is large print, and we can make that happen. Those CapTel telephones you see advertised on television,
right,
those are for people who are hard of hearing that you and I are going to be doing. And let me just add one more thing. The number one disability from every war since the Civil War has been hearing loss.
Wow. So a lot's coming down the pipe. That's Julia Sain, Executive Director of Disability Rights and Resources, with a just scratching the surface a little primer on the deaf and deaf culture. And I want you to come back, and we'll talk at length about this in the future.
Okay? Thank you, Mike.
Thank you very much. It's been nearly a year since the city of Kannapolis announced a unique step forward in their quest to revitalize the former textile town's downtown. The city bought a large chunk of the downtown area in hopes of priming the pump for development. And this month, they took another step in that effort by securing the first developer partner to weave the first part of the fabric of a post-textile Kannapolis. I can't take credit for that. Somebody else wrote that. Here to update us is Mike Legg, City Manager for Kannapolis. Welcome back to the program.
Thanks for having me.
And Pete Floats is a principal with the Lansing Melbourne Group, LMG. That's the city's choice for the development of a $60 million mixed-use district known as the Demonstration Project. Peter Floats joins us by phone. Welcome.
Morning.
So let's catch people up, and particularly newcomers to the area who may not be terribly familiar with the history of Kannapolis. It was founded in 1906, was owned for much of its history. The entire town was an unincorporated area owned for much of its history by Cannon Mills, the largest producer at the time of sheets and towels in the world. And then in 2003, when Pilatex, who was the successor to Cannon Mills, closed, about 4,300 people lost their jobs. And that was just part of the challenge that Kannapolis faced. Downtown Kannapolis was dominated by millions of square feet of this enormous Pilatex factory, which was then, I think, purchased by David Murdoch and
Correct.
Destroyed, imploded, taken down, so that he could build his research park. Was all this normal for a mill town? Is this how mill towns came to be and came to exist?
No. We're probably as unique as any place in America regarding how we've transitioned from textiles to a new economy. There's no doubt about it. And we're fortunate to have somebody like David Murdoch invest so much money in our downtown. So that's been a help.
I mean, you've built a brand new city hall, and it's the first city hall. This town has been in existence since 1906, and you just built the first city hall. And that's because it was not really a city. It was owned by – it was really a company.
It was until 1984 when we incorporated, so we're still a young city. Okay. I mean, we're 30-plus years old, but we've changed a lot in the past decade, and a lot of that has to do with the transition from the mill, but also with the growth of Charlotte. We're so close to Charlotte that we're starting to see those impacts over the past decade. So it's sort of twofold. It's that transition
now,
plus just natural growth.
In the mid-'80s, when I first came to town, people would go to Kannapolis from around the area to buy sheets and towels because they would come right out of the factory into the stores on Main Street or whatever that street is called up there into a very nice setting, and you'd buy sheets and towels at a very good price. This is before sheets and towels became cheap.
Right.
and there were some furniture outlets up mm-hmm. there as well. So that is the downtown that we all remember, correct?
It is, and it was built for that purpose.
Okay.
For the mill, for sure. It transitioned over a period of time after the mill started to contract and became more of a furniture kind of place. And most of that's gone, too. There's still a few of those still remaining.
But when the factory closed, over 4,300 people lost their jobs. So whatever shops remained downtown, I would think, fell into hard times. Am I wrong?
They did. Right now we stand at about 50% vacancy. And some of those are even iffy. They're sort of hanging on. So the whole goal of buying our downtown was to try to breathe new life into it. And the key to all this entire master plan that we've put together is to add anchors and add people. We got to add things that bring people into downtown because it's not going to create its own foot traffic.
Right.
We've got to add things to do that.
Pilatex went away in 2003. And in the interim years, David Murdoch has been working on building his research campus.
Mm-hmm.
How would you describe the mess that Kannapolis found itself in, and what took so long from 2003 to 2016 for this project to begin?
Well, for the first, after the mill closed, after David Murdoch bought it, after he announced the North Carolina Research Campus, he tore down 6 million square feet, spent $60 million of his own money to do that,
right,
just to create a clean slate. That was the focus for the first decade. Let's facilitate this massive investment by a private investor. Let's figure out what we can do to facilitate that, because that can be one of those anchors that can help our traditional downtown to have that built. So $600 million of private investment later, we've come a long way in a decade. So downtown's sort of the next step in that whole process.
And I want to talk about this unique step of the city buying essentially the entire downtown. But I want to bring Peter Floats into this conversation. He's with Lansing Melbourne Group, and they are one of several companies that put forth ideas on what they might do for this first development project. And I'm just curious, Peter, because you've done this in other places in the country, and you've been doing this for a long time. This is such a unique situation, and you're really starting from zero on this project. Why is it even attractive to developers?
Oh, this is absolutely a once-in-a-lifetime opportunity for somebody in our business to have a partner in government who's taken the bold step of actually buying an entire downtown and controlling their own destiny. This is not something we see every day. I've been doing this in one form or another for 40 years now, and normally the biggest problem we've got when we decide that we like a market or we're attracted to a market is acquiring the property, assembling small parcels. Usually in downtowns, it's the oldest part of a town. The parcels are very small. They're owned by many different people, and not everyone has the same idea about value or whether or not they're ready to go or whether or not they see the same vision that we do. In this particular case, we have a city that's accumulated all the property already and said, show us your vision and we'll pick the one we like the best. And so going in, we're working with a government that likes the vision that we have, that's done the hard work up ahead and really blazed the trail for us. So we're hoping to get our $60 million in the ground here in the next 12 to 15 months.
Would I be right in saying that this is kind of a blank slate, that when I guess they put this out for bids, I don't know how this process works, but when they put it out for bids, did they have parameters, or did they say, here's what we've got, what would you do with it?
That's exactly what happened. It was, here's what we've got. We've done an idea for what you might think about on this demonstration project. We took sort of an additional step of confidence in our potential partner and said, not only do we want to do the demonstration project, but we want to do another block right away. And they liked that idea. I think they liked our aggressive optimism. We love the market. We think that this is one of the three or four best markets in the country. We like mill towns. I'm actually sitting right now in Manchester, New Hampshire, an old mill town from the early 1800s, late 1700s, where we're getting ready to develop a hotel that's in the middle of 6 million square feet of 200-year-old buildings full of software companies. Hmm. This is what we love to do, and it is really great to find a government that's as passionate about it as we are.
So, Mike, the city of Kannapolis spent $9 million to buy 46 acres, which is essentially the entire downtown. And I did the math yesterday, and I'm math challenged. This could be really wrong, but I think given the number of residents who live in Kannapolis, it works out to about $200 a person. So how controversial or not was the purchase of all this land by the city?
It was absolutely not controversial. I've never seen anything like it. We did a good job, I think, of getting the word out of why we're doing it. This downtown has been in private ownership for almost a century.
Right.
Even Cannon Mills and David Murdoch. I think the community, by and large, wanted to bring it back home, and they helped control its destiny.
Why did you and other people in the city feel it was important for the city to be in control of this parcel of land, all of it?
Yeah, Peter mentioned it's difficult for developers to come out and piecemeal pieces of property.
Right. The
real reason, though, is David Murdoch was not going to sell to anybody but the city. So if we were going to make significant change, we had to be involved in this purchase and to facilitate its redevelopment.
We have to take a break. We're going to come back and talk more about this extraordinary, actually, and very and unique movement on the part of the city of Kannapolis and what the Lansing Melbourne Group is planning for at least the demonstration project. It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members in Piedmont Plastic Surgery and Dermatology, featuring plastic surgeons and dermatologists performing cosmetic and plastic surgery procedures and skin cancer screening, serving Charlotte, Hickory, Shelby, and surrounding counties. Details at ppsd.com. And the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, dedicated to promoting informed and engaged communities and committed to helping public radio advance quality journalism in the digital age. More at KnightFoundation.org. Budget cutbacks have made it impossible for lots of states to finance their public schools, but some have bucked the trend by increasing taxes and earmarking those funds for education. Taxes, spending, and the quality of public education, the topic of the conversation in 20 minutes at 10 o'clock on The Diane Rehm Show. You can join our conversation at CharlotteTalks at WFAE.org, WFAE on Facebook, or Twitter at CharlotteTalks. We're coming right back.
Running an airline isn't easy, especially when the lights go out, literally.
Fortunately, we were able to get the equipment back up relatively quickly, within a couple of hours. But at that point, the damage was done because the ripple effect of all the cancellations on one of the busiest travel days.
I'm Kai Rizdahl, Delta Airlines, in a conversation from the corner office next time on Marketplace.
Tonight at 6:30 on 90.7 WFAE, listener-funded public radio.
It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. We're talking to Mike Legg, the city manager of the city of Kannapolis, who has taken an extraordinary step of buying their entire downtown so they can redevelop it for the future. Peter Floats is one of the people going to help in that effort. He's a principal with Lansing Melbourne Group, it's LMG out of, Fort Lauderdale, Florida, who has bid on and gotten the project for
the demonstration project.
Which we'll talk about in just a couple of seconds. David Murdoch bought Pilatex, or the land that Pilatex was on, and has built this research campus in the hopes that he could attract scientists and other people on the cutting edge of technology, particularly with regard to food, to come there and conduct experiments and change the food industry, essentially. Is that working out the way he wanted to, or does he need Kannapolis to be redeveloped in order to not only attract people, but house people and give them things to do when they're not working at the research campus?
Yeah, I think it's a partnership for sure. I think we need each other. There's no question about it. He wouldn't have sold the property to us if he didn't feel like we were good partners. The campus is working out great. The recession really hurt sort of momentum, so they're having to regenerate that momentum now. There's probably about 600 researchers that work on the campus and support staff. That could grow exponentially over time, though.
So people who have not been around since 1906 may not realize just how vibrant Kannapolis was in its heyday. I had no idea, but it had hundreds, thousands of people living downtown. It was a mill town, so they were on shift 24 hours a day. Shops were open from 6 a.m. till 10 p.m. There were 7 movie theaters downtown. This is like a megalopolis at one point.
It really was. I mean, and I think that's part of the community's desire to see some of that come back. We'll never get to that. That was an entirely different environment then. But those pieces, though, of activity vibrancy.
Well, what is your vision? What do you want to see happen? What would you like to, if it all works out the way you see it, what will it be like?
You know, 80-90% vacant, 10% vacancy rates in all the buildings, an entertainment district with restaurants and you know, some retail. Retail will be tough going forward. Retail is tough everywhere.
Right.
Entertainment, people downtown at all hours of the day and night, into the weekends. The foot traffic is really critical. That's what we want to see.
Have you talked about light rail yet? I'm just kidding. Peter, your company has been selected as the demonstration project developer. And I guess that means literally that what you're being asked to develop and build is going to be an example for others to see the possibilities of what could be done. Am I right about that?
Yes, I think we're going to be working to set a standard that both we and our partner, the city, feel is what they want to see in the rest of downtown. So we're going to be working hard on all the details. I've never, ever, ever been involved, and again, done this for a long time, never been involved with a group that is this optimistic, that lacks the cynicism that's evident in so many places in government today, and really is pushing us on schedule. We're normally the, as one of my partners calls us, the gas pedal guys, and that is not the case here. The city's driving the bus. They're pushing us hard to get aggressive on schedules, and we're doing that now.
Well, you mentioned a moment ago, I believe, that the city was looking for companies to put in their ideas for the development of a city block, and you want to do two city blocks, and so they've given you that opportunity. What will you be building, and where will it be?
Well, there's a block of existing historic retail buildings that we're going to be just south of, on each side of West Avenue. You called it Main Street before. There actually is a Main Street, but it's not what you think the Main Street is.
So
the street today where all the retail shops are. And I think one of the key components of our proposal that everybody liked and that we thought was a little different was we suggested that a retail leasing plan be put together for the whole downtown and that we be required to participate in that, so that we're all using the same real estate brokers, we're not fighting over tenants, we decide what we want in which part of the street, and then we go after that with everybody's resources together. We also think that a hotel is important in downtown. We think bringing people who are new every night, it will be an important component of feeding restaurants and entertainment uses that might be in the downtown. And then we're going to be building residences. We're going to start out with rentals. We're going to try to attract the millennial market downtown because those are the customers for entertainment uses and restaurant uses and the like. They're the first sort of pioneers usually in a redeveloped downtown. So that's going to be our target in the beginning.
Have you found, given your experience over 40 years, have you found that, I hate to be trite about this, but if you build it, they will come? Or could you be building a white elephant?
I'll tell you, if you build it and you build it right, you give people a lifestyle that they can't find anywhere else nearby at an affordable price, they will come. There is no doubt about it. Especially right now, the recession caused so much guardedness in the investment community in general. What we've got is a building industry and a development industry that is way behind the curve in terms of population growth and immigration in the country. So we feel that in places where people want to live, and we think Kannapolis is one of those, if you build it, they absolutely will come.
Because you're talking about building 271 residential units and a 116-room hotel plus retail, and the city's building a 506-space parking deck to go along with this, two blocks of development. It would seem to me to be very hard to start at ground zero because you have a chicken and an egg problem.
Yeah.
How do you get, and are there jobs for the at least 271 people who would occupy these residential units, probably more? Are there jobs for people in the vicinity that would make it attractive for them to buy or lease there?
Well, I'll say this. Mike said it before. There's 600 jobs a block away today. And those people, you know, for what you described before, if you think about it, this place was Silicon Valley 100 years ago. That's what mill towns were.
Right.
They were where everything was happening, where all the activity was. And we're one day away at any given moment from a guy walking out of one of these labs with a donut that will make you thinner. When that happens,
yeah,
271 will fill up that afternoon, and we wish we could build more.
Are these apartments or are these condominiums or a combination?
The first phase is going to be apartments. It's a bit easier to finance that, and we think it's more attractive to the market that we're looking for right now. Future phases may have condominiums. We know that that's something the city would like. They'd like an ownership community in the downtown. But we're going to start with apartments, and it may well be that the hotel comes first. We're actually weighing that right now. Over the next 8 weeks, we're going to be working hard on market research and trying to figure out what should be the first thing out of the box.
I hate to inject cynicism into this, or sarcasm, but hotel, Tell me how that will be used and by whom, Mike.
Well, I think there's two answers to that. One, we are talking about a couple of things. One, we're talking about building a sports entertainment venue downtown, which is a baseball stadium. Also talking about ultimately a performing arts center downtown. Those things generate hotel rooms. You know, the research campus, there's clearly some indication that they need hotel rooms for people that come in and out. But largely, hotel decisions are made on a regional basis. How many hotel rooms, how many keyed rooms are there right. in the region? And is there a market for that? That's what's going to determine it.
How far away would this baseball stadium and or performing arts center be in terms of time, in terms of actually being on site, built, ready, open, and operating?
Yeah, 2019, 2020,
really?
In that range for the first one, for the stadium. The Performing Arts Center is a little further down the road. We can't do both. We can't afford to do both. But we can't afford to do the first one. That's a pretty important piece to this big puzzle.
For people who don't know, you have a minor league baseball team. It's the Kannapolis
Intimidators.
Intimidators.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Great name, by the way. It's a great name. Are you looking to create or recreate a downtown the way we thought of downtowns in the early 20th century? Or are you talking really about new urbanism and something like a Birkdale Village?
Yeah, I think it's probably a little of both. I don't think you can recreate what happened, you know, 100 plus years ago. But there's elements of both.
But why not? Given the fact that Peter just mentioned millennials, millennials don't particularly care about, many of them don't particularly care about owning a car and would prefer to be living in an area where they can walk to restaurants and be with their friends and walk to recreation and walk to work, et cetera, walk to the grocery store and back. Why not? Why wouldn't a traditional downtown work with these people who are becoming the largest segment of our population?
Yeah, no, I think it can. I think we have a very, very walkable downtown. We have one grocery store, another one on the way. Very few cities our size will have two grocery stores right within walking distance of their downtown. So that's a positive. The entertainment things we talked about, you know, those are things that attract people to stay and be there consistently. So I think we do have the bones for that kind of resurgence like what existed 100 years ago.
What's your take on that, Peter? Because you're sitting, I think you said, in Manchester, New Hampshire. Is that where you are this morning?
Yes, I am.
And this idea of revitalization, and it's an old mill town. Isn't Manchester an old mill town?
It's a very old mill town. At one point in history, was I think the largest producer of wool in the world.
So it's kind of a northeastern thing. These tight knit Southerners were spread out. It's very northeastern to have a lot of density. So is this something that you see working in the South? Is this something you see working in the 21st century, given the shift in population and the desires of the people in that population?
Well, Mike, I don't think we have a choice. I think that density is the future as far as development goes. What we learned from our mistakes, I'm educated as a civil engineer and as a planner, and I was certainly a part of what happened in the 80s and the early 90s when we were closing streets and turning them into malls in downtown and essentially putting people out of business by taking away that sort of Main Street feel. Our children are not driving. Our children are living in smaller places. I read an article just the other day about the McMansion officially being declared dead, finally. And people are realizing that interstate drive home to the suburban quarter-acre lot or third-acre lot is not a viable future for the country, not a viable future for the next generation. They want to be where there's life. They'd prefer to spend their money on entertainment and travel and being with their friends and actually being a little more frugal than perhaps our generation was. And so we think that that's absolutely what has to happen. I would say that we're not trying to duplicate what was there 100 years ago, but we certainly want to take the best of what there was and then leverage that to build a lifestyle for people where they want to be, near where they work and near where they entertain.
This demonstration project, Mike, is 4 acres. I think you have 44 acres at your disposal. Have you sat down and mapped it out? Do you have a master plan for what it's going to look like, or is this something that's going to happen as each of these developers comes in?
Yeah, we absolutely just had our city council adopt the master plan in July. And, you know, it's flexible in that LNG, for instance, they have proposed something slightly different than what our master plan showed, but we fully expected that. There are some.
And won't that continue to happen?
Absolutely. Absolutely. You know, development community is going to know better than we know about what works and what won't work. So our plan is just a plan. And there's some immovable parts. When you build a stadium downtown, it's got to be somewhere, and you make that call, and that's where it's going to be. And you work around the big things. Our historic buildings, probably four blocks of this 40-plus acres, almost 50 acres, is going to remain intact, and we've made that decision. So there's some things that aren't going to change. But this 4 acres, for instance, LMG is developing. They submitted a proposal, did a lot of work. They invested a lot of their own time and money to show us how they think it can work. That will be the model going forward.
What's it going to look like? If you built it out today, what would it all look like?
About 1,500 dwelling units, probably the highest residential density in the Charlotte region outside of downtown.
How tall?
6 and 7 stories max.
Wow.
This first one is probably a 5 to 6 story project.
I'm going to re-bring up a conversation that we've had many times on this program about Charlotte and the explosion of apartments, and they all look the same. Will yours all look the same? Or will they look like Charlotte's, or will they look like something different?
That remains to be seen. And that's one of that is one of the key topics that LMG and the city will be discussing over the coming weeks, is what this thing will look like. Because if you've been to our downtown, it's very traditional. It's the research campus built was very traditional, Georgian architecture, lots of brick.
Right.
But we probably can't sustain that for every development. It's not cost effective. So there'll be a mixture, but design and the way it looks is really going to be a key issue going forward.
The mayor of Kannapolis sees a day in the next 20 years when downtown Kannapolis will support 10,000 jobs and 3,000 residents. What will it take for that to happen?
Sticking to the plan. I think this plan is a really good plan, supporting the private sector investments, making the targeted public investments. It will not happen if we make no investment. We're talking about $100
million. Already invested, what, $61 million in this project alone, right?
Well, the developer will. We've invested, you know, probably $15 million in purchase and other things, but building the stadium and other things. We've got to make those investments or it will not happen.
So very quickly, Peter Floats, when does it start? When do you open?
Everyone is invited to groundbreaking next June. Hopefully we can get that a little quicker than that. I know the city would like us to, and we should be open starting between 12 and 14 months later.
Peter Floats is a principal with Lansing Melbourne Group. They're the folks building the demonstration project to begin the revitalization of downtown Kannapolis. Mike Legg is the city manager of the city of Kannapolis. Keep us posted.
Will do.
Thank you both for the time. I appreciate it.